Greetings. You're now listening to the most handsome and intellectually superior specimens on Earth. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Starts now.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day it is where you are. We hope that you're doing well. We're pleased to be able to bring you another episode of I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. My name is Fresh, and we're thankful that you decided to join us today. Before we get into this week's episode, I'd like to remind you that if you like what you hear, please go to Apple Podcasts and rate our podcast and leave us a comment or two. In addition to Apple Podcasts, the podcast is now available on Google Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and CastBox, with more outlets to come in the future. You can connect with us on our social media platforms, on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at ICBW Podcast. That's at ICBW Podcast. And be sure to like, comment, and follow, subscribe. You can also check us out on our website at ICBWPodcast.com. That's at ICBWPodcast.com. Be on the lookout for our new merchandise store coming later this year. We appreciate your patience, and we apologize for the slight delay on the opening of the merchandise store. But hey, we appreciate your support in advance, man. We're going to have some real hot stuff up in there, man. And we appreciate all of the inquiries that we've gotten to my post about the shirt and other things like that. So trust me, we got you, man. We got you. But we just like to do things right and in order. So it's going to be just a little bit longer. But hey, we appreciate you checking for us, man. Today, we have a very esteemed special guest. Everybody knows here at I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It, we stress education, literacy, and a few other things, but we really believe in education, and we are privileged to have an esteemed educator on the show today. Our guest received her doctorate in education and an educational specialist degree in educational leadership from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, a master's degree in middle grades education from Appalachian State University, and a bachelor of science degree in special education with a certification in learning disabilities from Winston-Salem State University. She has additional areas of certification in public school administration and principalship, curriculum and instruction with a concentration in English and North Carolina superintendency. Her dissertation topic, a study of elementary principles, perceptions of accountability and leadership in an era of high stakes testing, is a foundational part of her book, which we'll discuss today. It's called The Heart of School Transformation, My Journey into Transforming Urban Schools. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Essie McCoy. Good afternoon, Dr. McCoy. How are you doing today?
Good afternoon, Mr. Livingston. I am doing well. And I just want to say thank you so very much for allowing me to be on your podcast show. Indeed, it is an honor. So thank you.
It is not a problem at all. We are definitely blessed to have you here today. To have someone that has so many accomplishments and so much experience within the educational system to be able to try to impart some knowledge to the audience today and to try to encourage educators from around the globe to make an impact in the system. We are definitely it is our pleasure. So we definitely thank you for being here. We want to go ahead and get right into it. If you can just tell us a little bit about yourself, something that's a little personal, but not too personal, just so that people can kind of understand, your personal background and how you've come up to this particular point of being an esteemed educator.
Indeed. I do want to once again say thank you for this opportunity. And I am not like most of the people that are out here. And that is that, I worked really hard in terms of earning 4 degrees. Some people will say, you don't have to go to college. And that is accurate. And you wouldn't think that somebody with 4 degrees would be saying that. However, I have learned from experience and from personal knowledge that after I acquired 4 degrees, I actually have a daughter. And she told me when she got to high school, she said, "Mom, I do not want to go to college." And I said, "Okay, what is your plan?" And for my entire career, almost 30 years in the public education system and currently still in higher education, I would tell kids, go to go to college. That is true for some people. You have to get an education, but your education can be in different areas. Definitely, you know, you can go to college and acquire a degree, or you can go to the military, become an entrepreneur, gain a trade or a skill or an apprenticeship. So I really try to convey that message. I grew up in Milwaukee, North Carolina, eastern part of North Carolina, very rural, also very humbling beginnings. So when we talk about At Promise students, I know all too well the story because I have lived the life. I talked a little bit about my daughter. I also have a son, and he is, of course, an African-American black kid, and he plays baseball. So definitely the journey of whatever kids so desire, we have to make sure that as the educators, as the parents, as the community members, that we are really being supportive and that kids are living out their dreams. And that's what it's all about. Kids have to find passion, and they have to start looking for that early when they're in middle and high school, talking about it, thinking about it. And definitely those are some of the things that I did, and I am where I am today because of that.
Great. So let me ask you this. I mean, you talked about having 4 degrees, and I mentioned a little bit about your educational background in the intro, but will you just run down for the audience and let them know, you know, where you have your degrees from and what pointed you in that particular direction?
So I actually started out in the field of education, went to Winston-Salem State University, received my bachelor's degree in special education with a concentration in learning disabilities. And really, I would go into, when I was an elementary student, I would watch my teachers constantly, and I would go home and emulate them and play school. I had no idea that that journey would put me on the path that I am today. And so I am so grateful for those positive role models that I saw every single day. Not only the teachers in the elementary level, at the elementary level and middle school level, but also my parents telling me about the importance of education. And, you know, I often tell people my parents did not graduate from high school. My father stopped in the 9th grade and my mother stopped in the 8th grade. And so definitely those were my heroes, not only the educators, but my parents. I went on, and after I finished my degree at Winston-Salem State, really wanted to make a bigger impact, and so went back to school and received my master's degree from Appalachian State University, middle grades education with a concentration in English and certification in curriculum and instruction. Decided to continue my educational journey and went to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and actually received my degree in educational leadership, and then continued to work on my doctoral degree at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, once again, educational leadership. So I have certification in different areas. Even though my doctorate is in educational leadership, I have, you know, principalship, middle grades education, the superintendency, and I've been very fortunate in that I've had the pleasure of going to Wake Forest University in leadership programs, North Carolina State University, Harvard University, the University of North Carolina at Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill. So actually went there maybe 3 or 4 different leadership programs. And Howard University, also I did the superintendency program there and at AASA. And taught at A&T State University, ITT Technical Institute, and continue to work at George Mason University. So when I go out and talk about education and kids ask me about going to college, you know, not only do I tell them that I have 4 degrees from 3 different universities, but also I went to many different universities, their leadership programs, and I taught at 3 different universities. So I can actually share with them a wealth of knowledge.
Right. And it seems like, you know, with you having, because you have some HBCU roots here, and you also have some PWI experience as well. And it seemed like that would equip you to be able to speak to kids, especially from our community, from a couple of different perspectives as to what the expectations may be when they actually enroll in these particular schools. So that's that really puts you in a position to affect change even more. I do want to go ahead and get into the questions that we have for you today. But just listening to you speak, I've developed a few more. So I hope you have a little bit of extra time so we can kind of go over those as well. But I won't keep you too long today.
That is certainly okay.
And thank you so much. We really appreciate it. But I wanted to ask you the first question. And we're kind of go with a high level overview, because a lot of our audience, you know, they don't have, you know, those 4 degrees, or they may have them, but when we talk about education, there needs to be more of a common ground where people can meet, so we can actually, you know, move things forward. So that's how we're going to approach the you know, the interview and the questions today. And I just want you to speak from your heart, and and hopefully we can set some people on fire today. Okay.
Indeed. All right. I'll try my best.
All right. So what is something that you've learned in the classroom during your education that you still use today? And additionally, what's the one thing that you learned on the job that you would use or encourage other educators to use, no matter the position?
Right. So I would probably have to say it's something very basic, but something that is very prevalent in some of the schools that we go into. And I would say you have to be connected to kids. You have to really, truly know kids and build those strong relationships with them. Kids know when you're very authentic with them. And so they can read you. You know how we say people can read you? Kids can really, truly read adults. They know if you really care about them. So that is something that I learned in the classroom. I started my career at an alternative middle school. These kids had been put out of just about every middle school, 2 and 3 and 4 middle schools. You know, some of them had criminal records. And so I went in there after college, 21, 22, I can't even remember now, but I went in there after college and worked with these students and really gained a lot of respect for them. And likewise, they gained respect for me. So you have to be connected to kids. You have to also make sure that you have high expectations for them, because they will surpass your expectations. If they know that you care about them, if they know that you love them, they will try their best to satisfy whatever demand or whatever expectation you may have for them. So those probably are the two main things: really being connected to them, having strong relationships with them, those strong ties, having those real high expectations, no matter where they come from, no matter where they come from. That is so very important that we have, we set the bar high. If a child comes from very low socioeconomic status or very high, it doesn't matter where they come from. We have to make sure we do have those high expectations for them.
Okay. So let me ask you this, because you talked about sparking a child's passion and feeding into that. And we're going to, you know, steer off just a little bit here. What would you do, or how can you feed into that passion, but also encourage a child to, quote unquote, make the main thing the main thing? Because they're in school to get an education based on what the state requires for them to quote unquote, be proficient and to move on and to, you know, ultimately graduate. So how do you as an educator feed into those passions that may not actually include the educational system, but at the same time pushing a student or students to, you know, to reach, you know, the requirements and the goals set forth by the system?
Right. So you do have those state mandates. You do have a curriculum that you have to make sure that you are implementing within the classroom, within that school-wide. And it's very important for teachers to collaborate with their colleagues, because while one teacher might be an expert in one content area, if they come together collaboratively, they can create very engaging activities for kids, and they can reach all learning modalities. For example, a child who is very kinesthetic, the teacher can create an activity based on that specific objective or that skill that is supposed to be taught in that classroom. They can design activities and lessons around that and make sure that they reach the child based on their learning style. There are many learning style inventories. A lot of teachers actually use those at the beginning of the year. There are interest surveys where they sort of gain knowledge about their students on how they like to learn best, what they're really interested in. And then when that teacher is sitting down on the weekend or on a Friday afternoon and creating those lesson plans, they can actually embed that into something that is very kinesthetic, as I mentioned before, that child who is, you know, a hands-on learner. So it's very simple ways that you can do that. There's all sorts of tools and resources online that you can incorporate, not only just in a classroom, but throughout a grade level, throughout the entire school. You can have programs and initiatives, the different STEM models that you have out there. There are so many resources nowadays. No child should be sitting in a classroom, and no child should be bored because of the lack of engagement. It should be that these kids are ready to come to school, they are on fire to learn, and they are engaged every single day. And also get input from the kids. There's not anything that they can learn that you can't relate to real life. And that's what it's all about, making sure that learning is relevant and that it's engaging within the classroom.
Right. Okay. So what you're saying is it takes a little bit of vision and it takes a little bit of cooperation at the same time. So talk about vision specifically. That's a leadership trait. And so what do you think is the most important trait of an educational leader?
Wow, there are so many. But I sort of think back to my journey, and I would probably have to say commitment and passion. Leaders have so many things that they are responsible for. And, you know, I'm writing a second book. Well, actually, I wrote my first book, The Heart of School Transformation, on my journey into transforming urban schools, that was actually published in September 2018. And then I was a co-author in Coaching Champions, and definitely another book that I am putting out in June, but also Behind the Scenes of Educational Leadership. So I would have to say commitment and passion, the ability to listen, to work with others, to continue to learn and develop. You know, even though I had 4 degrees, I had all the credentials that I needed in order to do what I wanted to do to really impact kids, I continued to learn. I would sign myself up for a program at Wake Forest or Harvard University and had the opportunity to participate in that. No one came to me and said, would you be willing to do this? Would you be willing to do that? So leaders have to take the initiative to learn and develop and grow themselves. Promoting unity, you know, a school that is a school that has a school family atmosphere, you're going to find that unity is within that school and within the community. Once again, creating those visions and the hope for those kids and creating dreams, letting kids be able to dream and let them see what it is that they could possibly become. I always tell kids, and my own kids, I told them this as well, that you do what you love and you love what you do. So going back to serving with passion, and know that, you know, we have to continue to adapt and adjust and create our skills so that we can impact the lives of others and use our talents in order to improve what we do each and every day. So you really, as a leader nowadays, you have to be multi-skilled, but you have to love education. You have to love kids, and you have to love making an impact, especially if you're talking about working in urban schools.
That's absolutely wonderful that you would say commitment first, because, you know, there are a lot of people that walk around doing jobs that they're not really wholeheartedly invested in. So, you know, the fact that you would put that up front as one of the higher traits, that says something about where your head is and where your experience is. So I hope that people listen to that and understand that you have to be fully vested. And we're going to talk about more about the heart in just a second. But what are some of the techniques that, if, say, for instance, I'm a new administrator, what are some of the techniques that I can use, especially if I'm going into, you know, a quote unquote urban environment, if you will, or I'm dealing with disadvantaged youth or at risk, whatever the term of the day is? What are some techniques that I have to have in my toolbox when I go into this environment?
Right. And, you know, I use the word at promise for a large portion of my career. Actually, I use at risk because that's what I was exposed to. But I think when we label kids, we tend to devalue them, and it gives you a negative connotation when you say at risk. Right. So I use the term at promise. Our students are at promise. I could have been an at promise student. I was an at promise student.
I was too. But I definitely was too.
Yes. So it's important that, you know, new administrators, they know where they're going. Don't go into a school that you really don't want to be at. You don't want to leave that school. You're there for the wrong reason. All the schools that I went into were really challenging schools, but I loved it. I loved working with that student population my entire career. That is what I did. So you have to know where you're going. You have to do your homework on the school, on the community. Once again, I talked a little bit about being multi-skilled in what you do, in your skills and your talents and your abilities. So you got to know yourself and know what you are capable of doing. Once again, you have to know the community. You have to know what an urban child, what their environment is like, whether they're in school, in the community. You have to know something about the urban child. You must know test data and survey data. And definitely look within the community and look at those resources. School leaders have a multitude of responsibilities. They have to budget. You have so many different streams of income coming into that school. You might have a school improvement grant. I remember one school, I had a $2.6 million grant. I had a large Title I, almost $1 million at one school. You have, at Promise, they said at-risk funding. You have so many different funding sources that you really do have to know how to do budgeting. Okay. Human resources. Definitely, you have to hire people. You want to get quality people in your building. You have to know curriculum and instruction, how to manage the different programs, the different initiatives. Child development is so important. You know, I've done K-12 and college, so I've done the whole gamut. But each level, I had to know something about the child. I had to know, how is it that elementary kids learn? How is it that middle school kids learn? So you must know that. And I probably could go on and on about that. But as a school leader going into a school, and especially an urban school, you must know that you are cut from that cloth in order to make a difference in that school. Don't just go in there for the wrong reasons. It has to be for the right reasons.
Okay. Which is going to bring me to my next question, because in reading your book, you said that transforming a given situation is not only hard, but it's heart work, as in coming from the heart. Can you describe what you mean when you say that?
Yes. And I say that every opportunity that I do have, and that is, educating kids. Schoolwork is hard, H-A-R-D work, but it's also heart, H-E-A-R-T, like you said, work. It is what motivates you. Why you do what you do, because it is your passion. You love doing it and you love making a difference. So you, not only do you impact them academically, but you impact the minds of the kids that are in that building. You impact the hearts of the children. You mold and shape them. I remember, I would do morning announcements. It's so important that we do those daily affirmations. Students may come into the building. They may come in from gunshots the night before. They may come into the building. They may have seen a fight. They may have not had any breakfast. They may not have had any sleep, no coat to wear to school, walk into the school or get into the bus stop without a coat. Kids come from so many disadvantaged situations. We have to be willing to just really impact them in a positive way and speak positivity and speak nothing but hopes and dreams, and let them really see that each and every day by the way that you serve them, by the interactions that you have. So we have to mold and shape them and create those beliefs and those dreams and those hopes that they have. People have to believe in them. You can't just have anybody working in an urban, highly impacted school. You have to have the right people with the right heart so that you can impact their hearts and we can really make a difference.
Right. Because, you say in your book that students who are disadvantaged must have constant reminders that they are capable, that they can create the future that they dream about, if they work hard and prepare all along. When leading a school, are there positive reinforcement staples, something that you would do over and over, such as the daily affirmations that you would implement? And also, how would you put students in a position to actualize, some of their skills? It kind of goes back to the other question that we talked about before about, feeding into that passion. But in that toolbox of an administrator or a leader or just, or classroom teacher, what staples do you have to have at the ready to be able to implement to be able to pour positivity into these children's lives.
Right. And the great thing about my book, going back to that, is that I did give a lot of very tangible things that leaders can implement. So I would encourage people to purchase the book, but not only purchase the book, read it and actually implement some of those things. I was a big believer. You know, my mother was an evangelist. My father was a minister. I am in divinity school. So definitely those daily affirmations. You have to speak life, speak dreams, speak hope into the kids, those mentors in the schools. You know, in the field of education, I do an educational show in Maryland once a month, and it's an educational segment called Education First. And last month, I had an article from Education Week, and it talked about, I can't remember the exact title, but it was like, white teachers, you must get to know your students if really you're going to make an impact. So they have to have those mentors and positive role models in the schools in order to say, oh, I can be like that. Not to say that somebody of a different race, ethnicity can't do that, but sometimes kids need those positive visual affirmation, those people that are right there looking like them, sounding like them, speaking life into their dreams, those positive relationships. That is so important. As I said before, if kids know that you care about them and love them, they will do anything that they can possibly do in order to surpass the expectations that you put in place. All the schools that I served, we had extracurricular activities. We did some things that some of the elementary schools may not have done. We had hip hop dance. We had soccer. We implemented those things at the elementary level. It was like a carrot dangling in front of them to say, okay, you make a B or a C in this class, you can participate in this. And it was amazing to see, out of 830 kids, we probably had about 300 third, fourth, and fifth graders every single year who would want to participate in our hip hop dance program and soccer. And I mean, I could go on and on about the different extracurricular activities. Also, as a school campus, it's important that you have those campus-based resources. I was at one school, we actually had a health center. So we had a medical doctor there. We had a nurse there on the campus. It was used between the elementary and the middle school. One school, I had health services, so a counseling agency based right there in the school, because that is what was needed in the school for the kids, and sometimes resources for the parents. So it's important that you impact those social, those emotional, those environmental and psychological skills, along with the academic skills. And going back to the latter part of your question, when you ask about, you know, putting those students in a position to actualize some of their skills, we must make learning applicable to the students. For example, I did the morning news for the kids so that they could see me every morning. They could also come up and be announcers, and they could be broadcasters. We had students going out into the nursing homes. They did internships. So exposure and making sure that relevant activities and examples are being utilized and that learning is relevant within the school setting.
You know, you touched on so much in that particular answer. It led me to a couple of more questions or just some observations that I'd like your input on. When you talked about educators learning the culture of their students, how important do you think it is for Black children specifically to see more Black educators? And on the opposite side of that, if you are of another race, don't you think that it's to the students' advantage to actually take some of that culture from that particular educator, whether they're an Indian teacher or an Asian teacher or even a Caucasian teacher? I would think that it would be important for those particular educators to pour their culture into the classroom as well, because some of these students may never be, you know, interact with it or may never ever get the chance to understand it. What are your thoughts on that?
You are exactly right. It works both ways. And so, you know, if you look at all the research out there, it talks about mostly that in a lot of the urban schools, you can't find those certified high quality educators. I was very fortunate. We really were able to secure people who first had a heart to serve, who were passionate, who also had the credentials. But more importantly for me, you know, no matter what color you come in, you had the heart to serve. You loved what you did. And it showed when you came in that school, you interviewed, you took a tour of that school. We gave you an opportunity to interact with those kids within the different schools that I serve. So we first, it is important to have quality people in the classroom, no matter what race, ethnicity, nationality, that is so important. But I did have at one school, I had 33, 33, 33, meaning that, you know, I had a large Latino and African-American student population. But my teaching staff, we had about 33% Latino, 33% African-American, and about 33% Caucasian. In another school, I had mostly Latino students, about 65 to 70%. All these are urban schools, and I was able to secure educators with passion, with a heart to serve. But a lot of those teachers were Caucasian. And so what I did, I had teacher assistants or mentors that would come into the school. Even though in the classrooms, you might walk in there and you might see, you know, a lot of black and brown kids, large Latino, large African-American student populations in the classroom. However, even though they had a Caucasian teacher, you might see mentors coming into that building from churches and organizations within the community who looked like the kids. It was so important that kids had people they could really feel comfortable with and relate to, and it made a big difference. And I think that's why we had so much success within all the schools that I served, because of the balance that we tried to create and the difference that we tried to make with getting the right people in the right places.
And you mentioned something else in regards to some ancillary services, if you will. You know, medical services and, you know, other therapeutic type of things. And on this particular podcast, you know, we're really big fans of receiving therapy for trauma and other issues. Why is it that schools don't have therapists readily available? I know they have guidance counselors and things like that, but why don't they have more licensed therapists or even psychiatrists in schools for kids that, because just like you said, they may have witnessed a shooting last night, you know, in their own neighborhood, and or they may just be going through a lot of different things. There may be abuse, there may be neglect, there may be homelessness, there may be hunger, there may be a lot of other things that they have to deal with before they even get off of the bus. So why is it that we don't have that particular resource readily available at most schools?
Right. You know, it's so unfortunate that we do not. But the bottom line reason is it goes back to funding, the allocations. You might have a school psychologist who may serve three schools. They might go to an elementary school, a middle school, and a high school. And I'm talking about schools that are large, not small schools, within a week's time frame. So it goes back to funding. But you know, and I know all too well, the tragic situations that occur throughout this nation, throughout the world, that we do need more resources within schools at the elementary level, at the middle school level, to really help our kids who have some challenges, psychological challenges, environmental challenges. Educators, teachers in the classroom can't do this work alone. It takes everybody within the community. And when I talked a little bit about the new urban leader going into a new school, it is important that they look within the community in which the school is sitting so that they can say, okay, I can tap into this resource. And that's exactly what we did. We knocked on every door, every organization, every club, every community organization within that school community to really get the resources in for the kids. And that is the only way you can do it. Some school districts are very fortunate in that they have Black community initiatives where community organizations immediately align to a school. But if it doesn't happen, it is that principal's or that school leader's responsibility to go out and really secure those resources and create those partnerships. You know, you don't let money stop you. If you really want to make an impact, you will find a way in order to make that impact in a positive way.
Exactly. Exactly. So let me ask you this: as an administrator, would you accept, a licensed, psychologist or a psychiatrist? Even would you accept volunteer work? Because I can put out a call and say, "Hey, you guys need to start volunteering at these schools too," because there's a lot of PTSD that is going to be taking place that's going to go undiagnosed, and because of the circumstances that these kids are coming from. So as an administrator, would you accept, volunteer hours, from someone who has that particular expertise? I mean, obviously they'd have to be vetted or whatnot, but would that be something that as an administrator you would accept?
Indeed, most definitely. And, some school districts do have an initiative in place where they have outside agencies coming in. And like you said, they do have to be vetted and they go through that process and they get approved by the district and they can provide services to the kids within that school, within that school community. Others will have just volunteers, but they also have a process to go through to make sure they're okay to work with kids. So any resource that you can possibly think of, whether it's people volunteering or organizations volunteering, most definitely check with the school district in which you want to align your services with and then move forth in terms of their process that they have in place.
All right. So let me ask you one more thing, because we are we're almost done, but as you're talking, I'm making some notes here, and I wanted to ask you about a particular, I don't want to say it's an argument, but me being on social media a lot, you see a lot of different things, a lot of different opinions, and a lot of different suggestions when it comes to making our schools better and turning out a better product. So when a child comes out, they're more prepared for what the real world is like. So I wanted to ask you one specific question. You can give me your opinion on it. I saw something on social media where the suggestion was that we remove some math courses such as, Algebra 2 or, some other type of elective course and actually implement more personal finance, tax classes, budgeting classes, how to how to manage money, and how to actually survive as an adult while you manage your money. What do you think about? Not just, because I know you think it's important for people to learn how to do those things, but where I want your opinion is, what do you think if you had to remove something from the curriculum as it stands right now, what would you remove in order to have these particular types of programs within the school or within the system?
Goodness gracious, that is indeed a loaded question. And thank you for asking. I really do believe that each community, each school district, each state will have to look at that comprehensively to say what is the impact of that course or that particular curriculum that I'm implementing. What is it yielding? Is it yielding what I thought it would? When we compare schools, you're talking about some schools being compared based on the proficiency. In the state of North Carolina, you're looking at whether a student is a level 1, a level 2, a level 3, a level 4, a level 5. And you're comparing apples to oranges. So some of the schools, you're talking about a 100% free and reduced lunch school and a school that may have 2% free and reduced lunch. You can't even compare those schools. But what you do need to look at is the growth. I know one of the district that I worked in, we had the EBOS index. And so no matter where a child is in terms of their proficiency, they are growing. We are moving that child. So I sort of reflect back on that question. And I think it has to be, once again, based on the school district and based on the state, them working in conjunction and figuring out what is best for the students. And yes, I do know kids who have come out of high school. They are not in college. They have opened their own business and they're doing well. So that budgeting, the management, how to balance your checkbook, those life skills, we do need to invest in putting more of those courses into the curriculum. because not all children will go to college, and we need to find a way to meet those who may have a desire to do something else. While yet and still, we have to have all those prerequisite courses in place for the university track students as well. So it is a loaded question, but it's a great question, but I think it goes back to each school district in each state so that they can have a panel to look at that and have educators given input and not just politicians who may be disconnected from the classroom and not really have a reality-based perception of what goes on in a school day to day.
I got you. That was a real politically correct answer.
Well, thank you so very much.
I got you. But you also mentioned in your book that transformation will take place in other areas before progress is seen in test scores. What areas of improvement might be good indicators of potential positive movement in test scores?
Right. There are so many things, you know, the public and, of course, we as educators, we tend to look at test scores, but a lot of times, and I can tell you one school that I went into, I was there 7.5 years. Once again, 830 kids, 100% free and reduced lunch, all urban schools that I went into in order to transform. And that school had a 14 points growth gain. And I can recall back then people would say, goodness gracious, what are you all doing at that school to make such an impact with all the kids that you're serving in that community that you're in? And it was a lot of things. It was the day-to-day climate of the school. So that's so very important. A lot of times you will see that as an indicator before you see an improvement in test scores. Again, relationships. That's so important. You might have grants. How many grants have your teachers written so that they can get additional resources and supplies? The discipline within the school. Okay, you walk into a school, the discipline might be, you know, in terms of students being suspended or expelled from school, it could be 50 to 70%. Did you reduce that? The parental involvement also, you have to look at that. I remember one school we went into, actually three schools that I went into, they did not have a PTA in place. And by the time I left each school, the PTA, they were not only in place, but they were given a lot of input into the school and into the decisions that were being made. You can also look at partnerships and donations that you get. Are you increasing those? Look at all your survey data, because a lot of times you will get survey data about a lot of different indicators. Any awards that you have won, you know, you don't see that in the test scores. I go back to the PTA. If you have a backpack program, and I did at one of my schools where we served kids. We started out, I think, 1 year with 50 kids, then we increased it to 100, 150 kids, meaning kids would take home food in a backpack over the weekend so that they would have food, you know, when they were not in school. So it's a lot of indicators that you can look at to say, I'm making progress within this school, except test scores. Test scores will not always give you the story or the narrative of that school.
Going into, you know, the next question. So that's basically what you mean when you say you believe in whole child, whole education, and whole school impact.
Yes, indeed. I always say that whole child, whole educator, whole school impact. You have to have those wraparound services to really meet their social skills, their emotional skills, environmental, psychological, physicological skills. Like I told you, we put in soccer and hip hop dance at the elementary level. We saw kids losing weight. And educators, you have to have those wraparound services for them. You know, you have to look at the climate, the environment that they work in, their emotional well-being, because it's not an easy job. You know, I don't know where some people may get the notion that, oh, educators, they just work 180, 200 days a year. They have all the holidays off. They have summer vacations. Oh, my goodness. If you could only hear the stories from not only me, but educators out there. It will take an emotional toll on you if you don't find a way in order for a leader to build team building and relationship building activities into the school, socializing with the educators that are serving the kids. I mean, you're talking about maybe 25 to 30 kids in a classroom. You might have kids, all the things that I mentioned before, kids who are homeless, kids who have been abandoned, kids who, you fill in the blank. Whatever you can think of, you have have kids sitting in your classroom that have gone through those experiences. And guess what? That teacher within that classroom, they have to know how to cope and deal with all of that, in addition to teaching that curriculum and educating them. And definitely the school must have those services in place in order to create success and those partnerships that I talked about earlier. It must be a family environment, and you must be willing to listen to people and get feedback so that you will, as a leader, find out what is the best way in order to move forward to keep this school moving in the right direction for the kids, for the families, and for everybody within that school community.
Let me ask you this final question here, and you're probably going to have a lot to say on this. So I've read your accomplishments, you know, in the intro and everything. So it's going to be hard for you to pick just one, but given your range of experience, what accomplishment are you the most proud of at each level of your career? So in the classroom and in administration and beyond. I know that's a tough one, but.
It is, and I'm thinking, but definitely I would say in the classroom, I actually worked at two middle schools. So I was a middle school teacher, and going back to that experience, I would have to say working at the alternative middle school, that made me the person, the professional I am today, that experience in and of itself alone. I would wake up many nights and think about those kids and think about what bigger impact could I make in the field of education, and they are the reason I'm doing what I'm doing today. So definitely working at that alternative school. When I was the principal, you know, at the elementary middle school level, I would definitely say two urban elementary schools becoming signature schools. And that simply means that they were the highest growth schools in the district, no matter what title we had. And we give schools so many titles, and sometimes it has to be done that way so that we can get the funding. But when you talk about a school that is 100% free and reduced lunch, 100% almost minority in a high crime area, and you look at the police reports and all of the information that comes in, look at the crime within that area, Title I schools, school improvement grant schools, priority schools, you name it, schools are given the titles. And those are the schools that I went into. So I would say those two elementary schools becoming signature schools. And right before I retired, it was actually a middle school that I served. And when I walked in the door, it was a minus 8.99. And we had already reduced the EBOS index by a 4.72 within a 2-year time frame. Thinking back to the college level, I graduated from Winston-Salem State University. So I was given the Alumni Achievement Award. That was just an award of a lifetime. That is not given to many people. So definitely I am humbled by that experience, by that award. Also working at A&T State University and ITT Technical Institute, teaching people who had graduated from high school at ITT Technical Institute. I taught English, and so I had students coming in from different backgrounds. And then thinking about my experience at A&T State University, definitely working with school administrators, those people who wanted to become a leader, sharing with them those nuggets and those skills and those abilities and traits and everything that I could possibly spill and give them, I gave it to them. I have an opportunity to work at George Mason University, so helping teachers to develop their skills and really making an impact in that way.
All right. So you're definitely a change maker, And we appreciate you sharing your expertise and your passion with us today. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Essie McCoy. She's the author of The Heart of School Transformation, My Journey into Transforming Urban Schools. This book is available on Amazon.com, correct?
Yes, it is. And also, you can go to my website, www.dressespeaks.com.
All right. So once again, it's The Heart of School Transformation, My Journey into Transforming Urban Schools. Dr. Essie McCoy, we definitely appreciate you being on the show today. Do you have like an Instagram or anything like that, or are you just on Facebook?
I do. And so I'm on all the social media platforms. If you go to my website and go all the way to the bottom, you will see my Instagram link. You will see my LinkedIn, Twitter, actually two Instagram accounts and Facebook. And definitely I do a lot of speaking engagements, you know, still continuing to serve as an educator. I'm writing more books. I have three that are coming out, maybe four that are coming out this year. So educator, author, speaker, coach, president of Dr. Essie Speaks, working with teacher and leadership development, co-hosting a show in Maryland, faculty member at George Mason University, and the chairwoman and director of education of the DMV Mastermind. So you can keep up with what's going on based on all of my social media platforms.
Okay. And we'll put all that information out in our captions when we let everyone know about the show today. And so we want to thank you once again for blessing us with your presence and again, your passion and the information. And we hope that, you know, people would use you as a resource to tap into it, purchase your book and actually, you know, enrich their lives as a parent so they can see a different perspective, or even as an educator where they can pick up some tips, you know, from this book, because I've read the book and it is pretty in depth and it does give a lot of techniques for educators. So if you're a teacher, it's a quick read. It's not a 500 page book. So, you know, spend a little bit of time on a weekend or something and read what an expert, and when I say an expert, a true expert, has to say, you know, about these particular types of situations, because you will not be disappointed and you will come away enriched. So once again, Dr. McCoy, we thank you for being on the show today.
And thank you once again, Mr. Livingston. And, you know, I want to just say this. My book is not only for educators, teachers, but those school leaders, school district leaders, even universities. They can create their programs. How can they teach teachers to teach? What nuggets can they share? And so anybody, really anybody, and as a matter of fact, I had an opportunity to go into a school in the Virginia area and share with the kids. And guess what book I took into that classroom? My own book, The Heart of School Transformation, because it's a chapter in there that talks about my humbling beginnings. And I talked with the kids about that. And it was just amazing. So anybody can go out there and make that purchase. And once again, thank you so very much. I hope that I've shared knowledge and information that will impact people in a positive way.
And you certainly have. You certainly have. So we appreciate you being on the show today.
Okay, thank you.
I could be wrong, but I doubt it. So don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct. Then you should probably hurry. It gets crowded. Bring a friend with you. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct. Then you should hurry up. It might get crowded. Bring a friend with you. Expression Reds, their curators are cool. The culture and consciousness brought directly to you. Tune in every week for the newest of new and occasional politics as it pertains to you. Divergent point of views make for a whole picture, and we suggest you get your money up and take the shit with you. Ain't no fountain to you, but it's a secret elixir to ensure the black man as a permanent fixture. Standing here in America behind enemy lines, where more often than not my skin's considered a crime. Cops kill us daily and will never do time, while a crooked ass justice has the fate for mine. One day at a time is what my mama would say, and since mama said living ain't no time to play, and since I got a little game, I'ma give it away. But let's start the show before I get carried away. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. So don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct. Then you should probably hurry. It gets crowded. Bring a friend with you. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct. Then you should hurry up. It might get crowded. Bring a friend with you.
You just tuned in to I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It, hosted by Fresh and Reg. Holla back next week.